I'm a shot in the dark, wary sort of spark. I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, kids, episode 237. Whew, I tell you what. You know what they say about, there's that old saying about thank God it's Friday. And I don't normally feel that because I've never really worked a normal week most of the time. You know, for a little while I did a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday kind of a gig. Actually, it was more of an 8-to-6 or an 8-to-7 job. But at least I was off after Friday night, you know. So I kind of felt that weekend thing, but normally I'm like the old lady in Downton Abbey when I'm like, what on earth is a weekend? It's like when you work in the service industry, you're usually busier on the weekends. That's why when you hang out, when you have friends who are chefs, you're always, he's like asking, hey, you want to go out? And it's like Monday night because their restaurants close on Mondays, you know, but try getting him to do anything any other part of the week. So, but I tell you what, man, I know I've said this before. I'm going to say it again now. 3 weeks, 3 cities, 6 airplanes, 2 rental cars, and 9 open-to-close or nearly open-to-close shifts in between. It's just like, oh, I'm not doing anything. I ain't doing nothing this weekend other than sleep and cook. Actually, I am going. I've been claiming that I'm not doing anything all weekend, but then I realize that I am doing something this weekend. I am going to Croctoberfest, and Croctoberfest is gonna croc on. I mean, we're gonna croc till we drop. So my friends Carl and Sophia, parents of baby Maria, who loves me deeply. And who loves me way more than she loves Sarah Stacy, who's a quitter. so many inside jokes. No, they just had this little baby that just, for some reason, this little baby really, really loves me. I do pretty well with babies for the most part. Babies dig me. I'm kind of the baby whisperer. For a single guy that's an only child, I don't know. For some reason, maybe it's because I am a baby. I'm just very immature. I'm big. I'm kind of soft and kind of round. I'm kind of like, maybe they think I am a baby, you know. It's like like cats and your dog is like super stoked to have you back. And I read an article where it's like dogs don't know what you are. You're not a dog to them. You're like something really exotic and interesting, and they don't have a super good understanding of linear time. So that really interesting thing that's not like them at all has been gone for a really long time, and then you walk back in and they're like super stoked, right? The reason your cat is not impressed with you is that your cat thinks you're a cat. The same part of its brain that lights up when it sees another cat lights up when it sees you. That's why, I mean, he digs you. Your cat likes you. He'd crawl up on your lap and he'll pet you and lick you and stuff sometimes. He treats you the same way he treats other cats because he thinks you're a cat. Now, that being said, that means your cat's dumb and your dog's actually smart. Your dog's all goofy and stoked and your cat's all aloof and stoic, kind of has Asperger's, right? That's because your cat's stupid. You are a body soul composite of infinite value that has an intellect and a will, and you're like made a little lower than the angels. You're basically an X-Man compared to it. You're an angel compared to this cat, right? And it thinks you're a cat. At least your dog understands that you're something really interesting, gets stoked about it. So I'm all for dogs understanding reality. That was not in my notes anywhere. That one's for free. Well, let me tell you what you almost got to listen to today. You almost got to listen to me interview Sean Potts. One of the guys that is running things over at Focus, Fellowship of Catholic University Students. He was in my cafe, tried to rope him into doing an interview, worked hard on him, but he was staying on a deadline, chose not to do it. Chris Special Treat Stefanik walked by, tried to get Chris Special Treat Stefanik. dude, I have an hour. I have like 50 things to do. The guy's the busier. I feel some serious empathy for Chris Stefanik though. That guy travels so much. And after I've done kind of in the last 3 weeks, what that dude's been doing for 15 years. It's just like a different city every weekend. And it's like, I'm like, oh my gosh. Yeah. And I'm single. I'm like, how in the world do you do that, man? Oh, goodness. Oh, I'm not single. I have these children called a coffee house in the counter position. So, oh, goodness. So, I got a bunch of stuff I want to talk about today. Some of it's serious. Some of it's not serious. Some of it's not serious, but it's seriously not serious. Not sure how much I'm going to get to. So, I'm going to stop giving you the agenda. I'll stop telling you, hey, this is what we're going to talk about, because then I don't ever get to it, you know? So, so I had a man win, and I don't know if I told you about this. I can't remember if I told you. I remember telling you that I wasn't going to do it, but I don't remember if I told you I figured it out. So I'm going to tell you again. If it's been in the last 10 episodes, you can just drink. I replaced my headlight. The headlight on my car, which I've replaced. This is starting to sound familiar. I've told you about this. Well, anyway, I suck at like anything with my hands, like fixing things or anything. And I'm scared to death to mess with my car, 'cause I'm like, I'm going to break it and mess it up and it's not going to work and it's going to be my fault. So yeah, I changed my headlight and it's a minor win, but I felt like I was adulting. I was adulting and masculinating. I was masculining and adulting at the same time. So there's a win. So I've gone through my entire iPhone saga of the switchover here to the iPhone 7. I'm pretty happy with it. I dig it. It's good. I'm getting used to it. It works slightly different than that 6 I had. You know, the clicks and stuff are slightly different. Now, I was freaking out because I was just losing cell service out of nowhere. Like, I literally had no service right next to a Verizon store that I know you're supposed to have 5 bars in. And so something wasn't right. And so I went to Uncle Internet and I said, typed it in, "Dear Uncle Internet, is there a problem with the new iPhone 7 and Verizon reception?" And sure enough, they'd already found the bug, fixed it, and there was an update sitting for me to install, a new iOS update that fixes that some carriers were having problems with that, and Verizon was the worst. So, yeah, I was like going along like 3G where I normally have like 4G LTE. And like no service, like right, I'm like trying to get my Google Maps to like tell me where the traffic's kind of bad. So I'm trying to commute to work in the dumpster fire that is Denver traffic these days. So not this morning, yesterday morning, for the record. Yesterday morning, 7 wrecks, like 7 wrecks on the 25 South between me and where I work. It's like one wreck happens and it backs up, then people act like idiots, and another wreck happens. Now there's 2 wrecks backing it up, and it just chain reaction, just like people do stupid stuff when they can't go, and then they have wrecks, and it's just amazing. So if you're listening, Denver, stop it. All right, so anything else? Kind of in the sushi coma. Tried to get Stefanik to go get sushi with me and didn't work. 3 weeks, almost a month without sushi. And you know what? It was time. Occasionally I need very fresh raw fish in my life. It's just, I know, I never thought I would. If you're sitting there in somewhere in the Midwest or something, you're like, no way in hell. I am never eating raw fish. You're crazy. I'm with you. I was that guy. I showed up in California and they were all like, "Oh, come get sushi with us." And I'm like, "Oh yeah, awesome." Yeah. I'm like, "Roll that in cornmeal and fry it. Maybe we can talk." And, yeah, sure enough, I ended up loving sushi. Like, I don't even love sushi. I need sushi. Sushi is a necessity on occasion. It's just, it's like the blues. If I have to explain it, you wouldn't understand. You just have to experience it the first time. And if you don't love it, now that being said, if you're going to have sushi for the first time, get amazing sushi. Like, don't get cheap sushi for your first trip to sushi. If you've never eaten sushi, wait till you're someplace where there's amazing sushi and go get amazing sushi with someone who knows about sushi. So if you're coming to Denver, before you would go to the place that I go to, which is super good, go to like Sushi Den and drop like real money on a real sushi meal and taste like the pinnacle of how it can be. And then you're kind of go, oh, okay. Then you kind of get it. And then you can kind of figure out where the value is. But I'm telling you, sushi's where it's at. So I'm a little bit in the sushi coma. I've got, let me get back to my notes. I was looking at me begging my producer for some more time today on my Facebook messages. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 things that I want to talk about today that have come across my my proverbial desk. And by desk, I mean wherever my iPhone was. Because I was in motion most of the week. So I have about 7, 8 things I want to talk about. And we'll see how many we cover. You could count along if you'd like. And then you'll know, teehee, he didn't get all 7 of them in. If you count. So. All right. I'm in a mood today. Must be Friday. I mean, thank God it's Friday. It's time for the weekend. I love listening to NPR, the BBC. They're like, you know, you're listening to Weekend. I love the reversed kind of emphasis on the wrong syllable. Weekend. All right, you listen to the final Weekend edition of The Counterposition. I'm your host, Andrew Wade. Weekend.
Let my sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
Let me skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lift my blood. See only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew Whaley. And you're listening to the Weekend edition of Redbox Media. I don't know why I find that so funny. I think it's funny. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just go YouTube. Maggie Smith, I can't remember the name. She plays the Dowager Countess on Downton Abbey. And Matthew, before he got himself killed, said that he had, you know, time to work, you know, and he had the weekends that he could be working on this. And she says, "What on earth is a weekend?" Spoken like someone who'd been truly landed in leisure their entire life, you know. Oh, I wish I was a leisured man. I wish I had just like a family estate somewhere that I could just kind of run in my spare time when I wasn't hunting with the hounds. That'd be spectacular. All right, let's get it going. There's a giant nude statue in San Leandro. Is that where it's at? There you are, giant nude statue. San Leandro, California. So this tech park had made an agreement when they put in their building with the city of San Leandro that they would put in some public art. So they bought a 50-foot tall statue of a nude woman. It was originally over at Burning Man, and it's made out of steel mesh. And they put it, it's like 3 times the size of like Michelangelo's David. It looks to be about she's reaching up over and arching her back like she's stretching like a dancer, and her hands are probably like 2.5 stories tall. So it's a good size statue. You can see it from a distance, and there's a rail line right across the street. And it's interesting because this statue in SF, I mean this article in SF Gate had a few quotes from people And it's interesting. It looks kind of like a ballerina, but someone said if she's a ballerina, she should have some clothes on, said Tonat Watts, 57, a resident and the mother of a teen girl who stopped and stared at the statue on her way to work. If you've got kids, you don't want them seeing that, she says. Another parent, Keith Kerville, 48, studied the sculpture and then asked, why is it so big and so not clothed? Now, the name of the thing is called Truth and Beauty, and it's got some kind of like a feminist agenda in the sense that it says, like on the basis is what if all women were safe? Now, that's not really a feminist agenda. That's more of an ethical and kind of a justice dilemma. But, I'm going to say, I think the thing is beautiful. It's absolutely gorgeous, and it's really well done. I'm amazed. I wish there were closer up images of it. Oh, here's a couple of, there's a close-up image of the foot. So the foot, to get a feel for it, the foot arched up on the toe, kind of like a ballerina on one side, is almost exactly the same height as like this construction worker standing next to it. Oh, here there are some pictures. Wow, it's like made out of steel mesh with like a frame inside and stuff. And it's basically like a ballerina arching her back in up in this beautiful pose. And it's gorgeous. It's really beautiful. We've got those two big scary looking like alien stick figure dancers as public art in downtown Denver. And then of course we've got Stallion, I think is what it's called, which is the giant blue Bronco, like that giant blue horse, rearing up with the red lit eyes out by the airport. And I tell you what, man, nothing is more divisive around Denver than Stallion. I mean, you love it or you hate it. I love the giant sculpture out at the airport, which, oh, by the way, sidebar, it looks like this month, well done, DIA, they're doing a bunch of tours and lectures and stuff at Denver International about all the conspiracy theories at Denver International Airport. I really want to go on this and then talk about it on the air, because there's just crazy weird stuff going on at this airport. The art, the history of it, all kinds of strange stuff. The music even in one place, and it's like it's a weird scene, and they're going to address all this in this tour. So, but one thing about there's this giant blue horse. If you've ever flown in or out of Denver, you've seen it. And it has red glowing eyes. I mean, it's the most metal thing you've ever seen. I mean, it practically, like, you could hear the soundtrack of an 80s metal video in the background. It's so cool. And this thing killed its maker. This sculpture, as it was being worked on, fell over and killed the sculptor that created it. How metal is that, right? I mean, that's like uber metal, right? So I'm a fan of Stallion. I'm also a fan. There's a giant blue bear. I guess that's a blue thing for the Broncos or something, blue and orange. But there's a giant blue bear that looks like it's looking in the second story windows of the convention center downtown. People take pictures with it all the time and stuff. I love the giant blue bear at the convention center. I like quirky public art. Now, there's like the big scary dancers. We have these big dancers that you see on Spear Boulevard right by the convention center. They look like these kind of like alien like stick figure things. I'm not a fan of that. But this thing, this Truth is Beauty, this steel cage and mesh ballerina figure in San Leandro is gorgeous. It's really cool. Now, I'm just wondering what their problem is, because two things. A, if this was in a museum someplace, they wouldn't have any problem with it. It would be like, oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, it's a sculpture. And there would be one of many nude sculptures in any museum worth its salt, right? So why is it okay to take kids on a field trip to a museum that has nude ancient Greek sculptures and stuff in it, and it's not okay to put this thing, which is less... it's slightly less realistic than that because of the texture of the skin and everything. And it's not a suggestive pose. It's nothing. It's beautiful. I'm going to link it on the show notes, and I'm not putting it not safe for work on it, because it is safe for work, because it's beautiful, and nudes are not safe for work. So, No, certain nudes, right? But so I just wanted to talk about this for a second. You know, I remember a long time ago I talked about this. Bad Catholic published a blog post, and he said he originally wrote it for the Art of Manliness, but from the time he wrote it to the time he sent it in, they quit taking outside submissions. And so he went ahead and he says, hey, this isn't what I normally do, but I'm going to put it up here. And he was talking about the difference between the generations in regards to nudity, especially male-male nudity, and how our grandpa's generation were just perfectly comfortable hanging out naked in front of each other. No big deal. Men, no problem. We would just go to they would just sit around in the steam room, buck naked, talking politics. I mean, they didn't have a problem with it at all. We all have the same equipment. We're all men. It's cool, right? And then slowly over time, it's gotten to where, you know, I'm around kind of this younger generation, and you see them like at the gym, or like I've had a couple of roommates over time that were kind of millennial generation, and they act completely differently about that stuff than we did when I was that age or in high school. And you see at the gym, you see these old men, like the old men I'm always talking about chatting with when I sit in the hot tub, these like old guys, usually like old non-American guys. They're Americans, but they're not from here. They're like an old Israeli guy or like an old guy from Pakistan or something like that. These old foreign dudes that have been living in America for a long time. And just, you know, these old ethnic dudes, they're just buck naked, man. They go to the locker room. This old guy is like shaving, combing his hair naked. They don't care. Right. Well, Bad Catholic brought up this issue. He brought up this argument. He said that nudity has become inherently sexual. So all bodies are sexual bodies. And so nudity is inherently a sexual act now. And he's basically claiming this is what porn has done to us. This is what a society reacting to porn has done to us. And so if you are nude in the presence of another person, it is inherently a sexual act. So people that are not comfortable around that. And so I think there's something about our stance towards nudity where we're just not comfortable with it. Now, I'm going to talk about one more thing about this, and then I'm going to move on. So when I went to Austria, I was amazed. It's my first time in Europe. I've never been to Italy, so I'm sure it's probably even more so, like in Rome and stuff. You can't turn a corner in Vienna without seeing a big old statue of, like, you know, the Blessed Virgin and the Trinity and all this stuff, or like this story out of like classic literature. And so, I mean, it's like, and there are just nudes everywhere. They're exposed breasts on marble statues everywhere. There's just an ancient building that's now apartments. And the columns across the front of the building have been there for 1,000 years, and there are nude women holding up the portico, right? It's just, there's figures of nude people everywhere. They're all over the churches. They're on the facades. They're on the outside of the churches. They're on schools. They're everywhere. It's just, there's sculpture of nudity everywhere. And it's funny that people would now be having this kind of reaction where there's just billboards everywhere for Victoria's Secret and, you know, girls in bikinis selling Budweiser or whatever. And this beautiful statue that isn't really even, I mean, the shape is pretty lifelike, but the texture and everything, you wouldn't mistake it for a giant woman standing there, really. They're really offended by that. They're like, the kids should not see this. I'm amazed by this. I think this is a good argument why we ended up with the two idiots that we do have running for president, is because this is where we fall into in Western civilization in America. We're scared of a statue. All right, let's go to the break. When we get back, I'm going to talk about something other than naked statues. You're listening to The Counter Position. I am your host, Andrew Whaley. See you.
Then how we crave a hanging in a dark.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
People singing, please don't sting, but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, we're going into segment number three. That means I am two segments away from going and not doing anything all weekend. I'm so excited. It's time for the weekend. oh, I'm a pill today. Yeah, I'm just like, my goal for tomorrow is to just like sleep, like a lot, like to sleep for a very, very long time. Preferably, I mean, I'm shooting for like, I want to see the I want to see the letters PM after the time when I wake up. I want PM to be involved. I'm like, and I want to go to bed early tonight. I'm looking for like a sleep marathon. No alarm, just the software. I'll set my software for like 2 p.m. to like track how I slept. But I mean, I'm not using an alarm. I'm going to black out the windows, cover my head. I mean, I'm going for like marathon sleep tomorrow. Just like, that is my plan. 3 weeks. I haven't had a good night's sleep in 3 weeks. I'm ready. I need to catch up. I got sleep debt weighing me down. I tell you what, I am obviously, I did have a decent night's sleep, night before last. But it was like, I could tell I'm beat up because I think I mentioned this on the show at some point. My software had me like dropping off the cliff and I was below the line to said deep sleep. Like I was like right above dead for like 6.5, 7 hours. I mean, it was just like nonstop. And then I woke up and went to the bathroom. So last night, my foot was kind of hurting. I was having trouble going to sleep. I finally get to sleep. I wake up in the middle of the night, read for a while, finally get back to sleep. And I wake up this morning at like 5 o'clock, like with this screaming crazy Charlie horse in my right leg. And it like didn't want to go away. Like I was stretching it and it did not want to go away. And like, it still feels a little tight this afternoon. It was tight all morning. It's like, I don't know what was going on. And I've been eating potassium foods. I'm not sure what's going on, but man, I just woke up like in the middle of the night, like in, I feel like someone had just like snuck in my room and like stabbed me in the back of my leg. It was amazing. It was horrible in every way. So, that was bad. All right. So now we're going from a giant statue of a nude woman to another work depicting a woman that someone's in love with this time and a man and what they're going to go through to get this love. And why am I talking about it? It sounds like every other, like, you know, kind of classic love story. Boy loves girl, girl loves boy. Girl's family doesn't love boy and sure as hell doesn't love that boy loves girl. So girl's family makes it really hard for boy to be with girl, but then he works really hard and like makes it happen. I mean, it's like, you see that story in the scriptures, you see it around, right? Why does that matter? Why would I tell you about like some love story? Because it's by J.R.R. friggin' Tolkien. That's why. J.R.R. Tolkien, as in the dude that wrote The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, has a new book coming out. Boom. A new Tolkien book. So, how can that be? J.R.R. Tolkien's been dead for a while, right? How can he do this? Well, his son, Christopher Tolkien, has been over time putting together adaptions and stuff of notes that he left behind. One of them we see that came out a long time ago was The Silmarillion. It was all of J.R.R. Tolkien's writings and stories about how the world that The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings and all this takes place in. It's how that world kind of became that way and the history behind it. Well, this is a myth that builds the world that the Silmarillion lays out. And I think this story is mentioned in The Hobbit or one of his books. So there's so Tolkien's son Christopher adapted the story from the text found in the History of Middle Earth, a 12-volume compilation of material relating to the fiction of Tolkien, which he edited. It's amazing.
I didn't know this. He says that he'll publish it on the 10th anniversary of the last Middle Earth title, The Children of Hurin.
I didn't even know about that one. This one's called Beren and Lúthien, and it's about a man who falls in love with an elven woman, like an elven princess or something, and her family is like not stoked on her being in love with a guy, with a human. And so he gives him like this impossible task to go set out and do, supposedly. And then he goes and does this whole thing, and I'm assuming probably wins the girl in the end, because that's how those stories work. But I just wanted to, I just was like flipping through like, you know, little links on things I follow, and all of a sudden I'm like, new book by J.R.R. Tolkien. I'm like, what? So I knew there was a bunch of material laying around, and Christopher was adapting a bunch of it. But yeah, so this is a pretty good sized book. And what's going to be interesting is there's several versions of this story that he did over time. The more simple kind of primitive myth he wrote, and then kind of later changes and adaptions, where he's basically kind of playing with how a myth develops over time. And there's even poetry telling the story and all this. And it's interesting. I was just telling a friend about Tolkien that didn't know a whole lot about Tolkien. Tolkien was a monumental genius of the order that I just don't think exists anymore. It's like not this kind of genius. There's other monumental geniuses, but not this kind. I mean, this guy wrote all these languages that were in those books. Like, he designed languages and then used them in the books. And you can go YouTube it. There's YouTube videos of J.R.R. Tolkien, like, speaking Elvish. Like, he spoke these languages. He wrote these languages and played with them and learned them and could speak them. And then as the time progresses in the stories, the languages change. The languages adapt and get more and more complex, or get more, they change the way natural languages change. And it's just, I think that it's just something that, like, I mean, you might go, okay, he had a lot of time on his hands. This guy clearly had a lot of time on his hands. But it was just, you know, when I was talking about Andrew Sullivan the other day and about all of our distractions and stuff, I think one of the things that we've lost, one of the things we've missed out on, is the ability to just really be with something for a while, to really focus on something and really go deep into a project and get up and spend time on that project. And it wasn't like he had unbroken work on the Lord of the Rings. He was a don in Oxford. I mean, he taught classes. He was a teacher, but someone who would just, in their spare time and in their leisure time, and, you know, would be constantly working on something, and they could maintain their focus on this one thing and make something beautiful and make it come out. I just think that is, that level of genius is something that we're losing. You know, another level of genius, another type of genius that we're losing in some ways, but I think it's probably more likely that we would have some modern version of it, would be someone like von Balthasar, like Hans Urs von Balthasar, or Joseph Ratzinger, who's Pope Benedict XVI now. I've said it 1,000 times. I'll say it again, so you'd have to drink, because I know I'm saying this over. Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, is the single most educated, cultured, brilliant, soulful human being sucking air on the planet Earth right now. It's like he's on a whole different level. He's a monumental genius on that old school, of that old school kind, where he's got this beautiful scope
with this big, big bird's eye view of the whole across all these disciplines. And then he could turn around and dip down into biblical studies or dip down into word, you know, languages. He can dip down into speculative theology. He can dip down into philosophy. He can dip down over here, and he can always pull up and see the whole and see where this fits, you know, and that's the kind of monumental scope that Tolkien brought to this work. He's looking at, I mean, you can see a pretty clear influence of World War II and his experiences in battle and stuff in earlier wars and stuff. And you can see that in his writing. There's a pretty clear, you know, but what's interesting is it was written before World War II, I think the bulk of it. And so what's interesting is when you see Mordor on the edge of things and like all this stuff, and you it's clear, it's easy to see like the Nazis and all that stuff, but that stuff hadn't become clear yet. That hadn't really reared its head yet. And he saw that. He was just prescient enough to see that coming. He was prophetic enough in his art to see that coming. But he saw this, what he was really doing is writing out these big, big architectonic worldviews into this beautifully intricate, detailed story with all this realism underneath it of even languages and stuff. And he was talking, and that's just the way reality plays out. And it happened to play out in that way very quickly, right in the Second World War, right after. So go check my dates. If I'm wrong on some of that, then see all the times that I said I'm not an expert or a historian. So let's go to the break. And when we get back, we'll have the final segment, and then I'll get started on my weekend to listen to the Counterposition.
Then all the colored glass that painter's palettes mash, all the colors of my soul.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to save. Love decked myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely, and I'm dull.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, so speaking of things that are beautiful, that require long times of serious human scale sustained attention, you know, I was in, like, I've talked a lot about my trip to Flint, Michigan, and I've mentioned this before, but as I've kind of seen what I've told people about over and over again and what comes to, you know, obviously the big providential stuff that happened, there was a couple of huge, like, things where, like, God created, like, something that's so far beyond a coincidence that it's like, wow, that is so providential. But when I kind of got over the shock of those things and the overall kind of like, wow, God is really doing something in Flint, Michigan, I started looking back on the things, the people that I met that really made a difference in my life. And I've talked a little bit about Father James and about how he's this incredible songwriter, singer-songwriter, and the guy Luke I met, who's got this little small shop that he clearly threw together like pretty cheap, like, but so intentionally and so thoughtfully and so beautifully, just like this, literally like the single, I mean, I won't say that it's like the least you could do in a shop. I mean, in the sense of like, it's just, there's nothing to take away. And there's like, Coco Chanel used to say that, before she would leave the house, she would get dressed to the nines, and before she, and then she would just work as hard as she could to look as perfect as she could. And then before she left the house, she'd look in the mirror and she would always make a tradition of taking off one thing. Right. And there's another saying that's like, it's that perfection is not when you can't add anything else. Perfection is when there's just nothing else you can take away. So it's, there's something to be said about this, like that essentiality, right? That simplicity. And like I met Luke's shop, Wild Root Coffee in Flint. It's really just kind of like the coffee house. Now he does have a little bit of food. And you don't, I've seen shops that didn't do that, right? And his menu is bigger than, say, Proof Rock Coffee in London. So, I mean, you can boil it down more, but they're just, you'll see a shop and you're like, wow, there's just no reason to reduce any of this. Speaking of, Father James is calling me as we speak. Sorry, Father James, I'm on the air. If you're listening to this later. So one of the experiences I had, so I experienced him, I experienced, you know, Father James and his craft of songwriting, and I experienced the third person I experienced that just blew my mind was Tim Goodrich. And they were trying to, they kept meaning to introduce me to Tim the whole way, the whole time I was there, and I just kept never getting around to going and seeing him. And I almost didn't go see Tim. And I was late getting to Mark Giesecke's down in Pinckney because I went and saw Tim. But I'm really, really glad I did. So Tim Goodrich is the founder, along with Cynthia Montague, of this project called Sutorial Boot and Shoemakers. And they did a Kickstarter for the Buckham Boot. And they're in Buckham Alley, Buckham Boot, Buckham. And they're in the, they're in Buckham Alley in downtown Flint, Michigan, just a couple blocks from St. Matthew's Catholic Church. And they are, their official address is on Saginaw, but they're in the alley. They're in the entrances on the back of the building. So they're in this little alley where there's all these little shops on this alley, right? And so Tim was telling me that, or people were telling me about Tim, that he'd start off with like this, this crepe cart and doing some crepe stuff. And they ended up opening this crepe shop. And I think that he kind of sold that and they turned it into a shop on the same street there on Saginaw. And it was a really great shop. I had beautiful crepes there, which it was amazing. I want a sidebar story about my visit to crepe shop. So I went to the crepe shop. I ordered a crepe and I got a French press of coffee because Father Zach was meeting me over there. And then I went, they gave me a number or whatever, and I went to the bathroom. Well, Father Zach had got there, looked inside. I wasn't there. So he thought that he beat me down there. And so he was standing outside waiting for me. And so I come down, sit down, and I notice that he's outside talking to this, this homeless guy. And so he's hanging out with him for a while. And, finally I realize he doesn't know I'm here. So I poke my head out and I'm like, "Hey, Father, I'm here." "Oh, hey, I thought I beat you on my, you know." So he comes in and I see him, he brings this homeless guy with him. So, you know, he's asking about, you know, what kind of, he's going to buy him some food. And over here, I'm saying, like, "Can I get a burger or whatever?" He's like, "Well, they don't have that. They have crepes." And so here's this 6'7" Viking looking priest. You know, not even Viking. He looks more like, I don't know how to describe him, but he's blonde and just kind of Aryan, this big, tall, good looking young Aryan priest. Right. And he's trying to explain crepes to this, like, homeless black guy that we found out that was later just got out of prison probably, or not too long ago. So it's kind of a stark contrast, you know, black, white, short, tall, a priest who's like, kind of like, you know, eats paleo and does CrossFit and all this stuff. And this homeless guy that just got out of prison. Right. This is a kind of a study in opposites, you know? And so I'm kind of listening to them talk and watching them. So he sits down. So the guy comes and sits down and by himself, and he doesn't know I'm with Father Zach. And so he's hanging out for a while, and Father Zach comes and gets his order in, comes out, sits with me. The food comes and he's like, "Hey, why don't you come sit with us?" And he brings this guy over. So we have our food with this guy, right? And his name is Douglas. It turns out his name is Douglas. And he was from Louisiana originally, and he'd done some, moved to Michigan, had done some time, and just got out, and he was trying to, you know, get a new start. And it looked like he was kind of homeless. He was staying in one of the shelters. But what was amazing about my meeting with Douglas was that we talked to him for a while, and he listened to me and Father Zach talk about some stuff we had to talk about. And we were talking to him about his life and asking him questions and, you know, and then he got ready to leave. And Father Zach says, "Hey, you know, we're over at St. Mary's or St. Matt's, you know, come by sometime, say hi, tell us how you are, you know, if you need anything." And, the old man looks at Father Zach sitting down, the old man standing up, and he looks down at Father Zach and he says, "Y'all get the Holy Ghost up in there?"
And I look at Zach and I'm like, well, that's a good question. he says, we try, Douglas. You know, we try. I'm just like, that is a question. That was a great question. Anyway, so that happened at the crepe place. That's a total aside. But so this is the crepe place that Timothy kind of had a hand in at one point. So he went off to Southern Pennsylvania, and he apprenticed under a shoemaker in Southeast Pennsylvania, learning to make custom men's dress boots and shoes and stuff. He came back to Flint and opened this custom shoemaking and repair shop in Buckle Mallee in the downtown district there. And so then this girl, Cynthia, started working for him. They were repairing shoes and making a little something here and there. And they decided to like start making a line of shoes. And so he did a Kickstarter and it like got way overfunded and everything. And he just sold this one boot. Well, when I saw him, he has three boots to choose from. And he just makes the same three boots over and over again. And they're just riffs on a theme. They're basically the same boot. They're $500 a pop. Takes him 25 man hours to make one of these boots. And these boots are the record of, let's say it's an 8-hour day. This is 3 days of a grown man's work sitting there with two dogs at his feet in an old rocking chair with this leather in this last, and he's like got this and he's like nailing these little nails in and stretching this leather and gluing it down and all stuff and hand sewing and sewing these things together and putting the sole on and stacking the heel and all this stuff. And I mean, he makes boots the way we used to make shoes in this world. And you can buy a pair of these and resole them when they need it, and you will give them to your grandkids. I mean, they just do not wear out. These are made well. And if they do start to break, they can be repaired. I mean, this is a throwback to a time when things were meant to last, that you weren't just going to change out with every little fashion and everything. And the thing that I'm more interested in is each of these pairs of boots is a record of a really thoughtful guy with a stack of books like Loaves and Fishes from Dorothy Day and Ratzinger and all this stuff. I mean, books that I love, sitting on his little shelf next to him. He's got this little chalkboard that's got like the Psalm of the Day written on it. And he's just like sitting there listening to like, I don't know, like a Bon Iver record or something with this apprentice kid that wants to work there watching him. And he's just sitting there on his lap, nailing these little nails with this special tool and making this perfect handmade pair of boots. And I was just like, man, that is just not done anymore, you know? And so I was in my shop this morning and these two ladies come in, like I see every once in a while, and they're like 300 miles an hour, like, you know, professional ladies, got all this stuff going on. They're doing all this stuff and, you know, and they're just, you know, and they're talking about shoes and, you know, about all this stuff. And they're just talking about shoes and it's 300 miles an hour and all this stuff's going on. And they're on their phones the whole time and taking calls and talking while I'm making the coffee and talking to each other and interrupting each other with calls and texting people and all this. And I told the whole story of my experience with seeing Tim and how he made these shoes, because they were talking about getting shoes repaired. And they were like, wow, that's amazing. And they were blown away by it. And they left. And one of my friends was sitting there listening. And they were like, you know, why'd you take the time to tell those ladies all about that shoemaker in Flint, Michigan? And I said, it's evangelization. Oh, man, we need to get back to where we can pay attention and make something beautiful. All right. Hopefully I've paid enough of attention and made something beautiful for you to listen to today. And let's pull the plug and pop the cork on another episode of The Counterposition. I'm going to get started on my weekend. See you next time.
I'll take your place in my old stone. I'll take your place in my old stone.